This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft, is at the controls this morning. In this part of the program, we'll be talking a little bit about the ways that trade policy connects with the issues of immigration and perhaps also of workers' rights. And we have two guests with us here on the program today, one here in studio with me and one joining us by telephone. On the telephone is James Tindwa. He is the executive director of the Chicago Jobs with Justice Coalition. And this is, say, a Chicago chapter of what is a national organization. And we can talk a little bit more about what it's all about. Here in studio with me is Jennifer Tiagi. She is the executive director and also campus minister of the Illinois Disciples Foundation. This is an organization that's been here on the campus of the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana for a long time, doing campus ministry and also working on social justice issues. This weekend, tomorrow, they'll be having their annual fall dinner, and our guest, our phone guest here, James Tindwa, is going to be here to be the keynote speaker. We wanted to talk a little bit in advance about some of the issues that they'll be dealing with, and they were good enough to come and give us some of their time. Questions here on the program, as always, are welcome. We like to involve people in the conversation. You can do that very easily by picking up the telephone and calling us. 333-9455 is the number here for Champaign-Urbana. We do also have that toll-free line, and that means if it would be a long-distance call for you, you can use that line and we'll pay for the call. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Well, Mr. Tindwa, hello.
Good morning.
And thanks very much for talking with us. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And Jennifer Tiagi, thank you.
Oh, thank you for having us.
Maybe first what I would do is ask James Tindwa to talk a little bit about the Chicago Jobs with Justice Coalition. You've now been the executive director there for a couple of years, and this is indeed a chapter, one chapter of what is a national organization in various places, cities around the country, and here locally in Central Illinois, we also have a chapter of this now going that I know you were involved with. Talk a little bit about what the organization, the Jobs with Justice, is all about.
Yes, Jobs with Justice is a coalition of community organizations, of labor unions, student groups, religious organizations, civic groups, some policy groups. And our mission primarily is really we want to revive this notion that workers must absolutely have the right to organize, not just for their own self-interest, but it makes economic sense and it's good for our democracy. We're also, I think, on a broader level, we are a social and economic justice organization. We do work on those issues that affect workers, that affect communities, issues like health care, for example. We are quite convinced that the way to solve our health care problems, for example, is through a national, preferably single-payer system of health care. We also work on global justice. That means we're interested in making links internationally across borders with groups and other communities of interest to really foster the idea that our rights, the right to organize, ought to be globalized. That the way that we're going to advance democracy, not just here but across the world, is by promoting the right to organize. Mm-hmm. At least it's part of the answer.
Knowing something about the Disciples Foundation, it's not surprising that you would be in Harmony and would be interested in working on some of these same things. So, what led you all to want to organize essentially a local chapter of this organization?
Well, there's definitely a lot of labor issues going on locally as well as nationally, internationally. Locally, we have with the University of Illinois, one of the largest employers. Has six unions that are currently in the progress or have recently negotiated contracts. And we also have a lot of other building projects that are going on that have some worker rights issues that needed to be addressed. And so it seemed very important locally to get something going. And there were so many groups interested in working on this issue that it made perfect sense to form a Central Illinois Jobs with Justice chapter. Mm-hmm. So, and for the IDF, it's fits in exactly with what we believe in. It is a social justice issue. When we talk about workers' rights, you know, it's something that, you know, involves so many different issues like healthcare and childcare, domestic partner benefits. And it's just something that's so important because, you know, having worker rights makes a huge difference in so many different issues. Mm-hmm. So it was just a perfect fit for us to be involved in that.
Well, generally speaking here, let me turn back again to James Tinoy. Generally speaking, what would you say is the state of workers' rights in the United States today?
It's pretty dismal because I think we've seen over the last two, three decades concerted efforts. Very elaborate strategies by corporations to suppress and to frustrate the right of workers to organize. What's even more frustrating is that the public in general is under the impression that workers can simply organize if they want to the extent that they're not organized, they're simply choosing not to do so. They're not aware of some of the very insidious practices that companies, employers engage in to make sure that workers don't organize. It's pretty amazing that a company like Walmart, for example, with 1.3 million workers in the United States, does not have a single store that's organized. That can no longer be dismissed as just workers not interested in organizing. Walmart, in fact, is one of those companies that has mastered these strategies that have been so effective at keeping workers from joining unions. So part of our mission is really to let the public know what goes on when workers want to organize, the number of times people get fired for trying to do that, the captive audience meetings that workers force workers to participate in, where they showed anti-union propaganda, anti-union videos. And so it's just a very chilling climate right now. And part of the decline in membership, of course, has to do with general shifts in the economy. But there's no question that there's also been a very deliberate strategy by corporate America to make sure that workers don't join unions. Mm.
Well, I think you pointed something that certainly is a trend, and that is the percentage of the workforce that is unionized has gone down. And I think that we're coming into a time when perhaps also now there are fewer people who belong to unions. They don't have family members who belong to unions. Are you know, their parents were not in unions. We're getting away from that kind of personal connection, and it seems that also that makes it, for people like you, that makes it more difficult to persuade people that somehow the right to organize really means something, that it actually is is important, that it's gained benefits for workers in the past, and that it continues to be important.
Right. It's been exacerbated by globalization, you know, the pressure on companies to be competitive, and the loosening of global, standards, labor standards that are facilitate plant closures in the United States, where right now it's cheaper for a company to just close its doors here and locate in Bangladesh or India or some other place. And so it reduces the leverage that workers would ordinarily have to negotiate for better wages and benefits here in this country. And so that's sort of part of the story.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. I mean, one of the things that preceded, I guess, IDF's joining of the coalition is we've done a lot of work around the Coca-Cola issue. And when talking about Coca-Cola, I mean, they're not definitely one of the only companies doing this, but is a company that has outsourced a lot of its labor to different countries. Colombia is a big one, and India. And they are not known for their favoring of unions. And in Colombia have been party to allowing paramilitaries to kidnap and murder people trying to organize in the factories, who are trying to organize for very simple things, for, you know, a fair work day and for a fair wage. They're not asking for anything, I think, that's unreasonable. And you have that type of stuff going on where it puts, you know, U.S. workers against workers of different countries. And one of the important things I think that Jobs with Justice is focusing on is uniting workers, you know, locally, nationally, and internationally, because they all have a common interest in, you know, having the right to organize and to have fair rights in the workplace. So I think that's one of the great things that Jobs with Justice is doing.
Yeah, I think this touches on what is, I'm sure, for people who work as labor organizers here in the United States, is a really key issue, and that is the importance of workers' rights in other countries.
Absolutely.
That if you're concerned about the loss of jobs, That should be one reason you might be concerned. And then maybe you also might be concerned about working conditions for people in other countries. Well, you know, that really addresses both those things. So what that says is that it's important that we do whatever we can to support the rights of workers to organize elsewhere.
Right.
Now, so that's a really tough thing. I mean, what can American labor activists, organizers, people who are involved in organized labor do to try to protect the rights of workers in Latin America or in East Asia or wherever you're talking about to be able to organize there?
Yeah, I think structurally, I think one of the most important thing we can do is to make sure that when trade agreements are being debated, the debate on NAFTA, for example, took place in the United States. You know, but NAFTA was passed, unfortunately, under a Democratic president here, Bill Clinton, without explicit protections for workers to organize, without any real, direct requirements that environmental laws be safeguarded, human rights standards be observed. And so what you have when you pass trade agreements that don't explicitly do that is that you create an environment where companies are actually, I mean, it's an open invitation to outsourcing. It's an open invitation to the kinds of factory closures. Companies are just relocating. They go to Mexico because it's over there. The although they have labor laws, obviously they're less likely to be enforced. They're not as vigorously enforced, for example, as they're enforced here. Environmental standards, human rights. So it just becomes this open invitation for companies to relocate where they can maximize their profits. And so the damage that's being done is not just to Americans. There's a damage that is taking place in those countries as well. As the United States continues with these bilateral agreements with each country, what you find is that factory owners who are going to those countries to set up shop are also engaged in a very, very nefarious way in undermining the democracy project itself, because when you set up that factory, typically what happens is that they sit down to cut deals with local elites who themselves are under pressure to bring jobs to those countries. And so the composition runs something like this. The factory owner says, listen, you got to create a business-friendly climate in order for us to set up this factory. And what that means typically is that you have to suppress union organizers, suppress human rights activists, suppress environmentalists who are going to be concerned about local, discharge into local water and air and so forth, people who are going to be concerned about whether children are going to be used in these factories or not. And so when you undermine labor and the advocates, child labor advocates and all those, that's really at its core, that's what democracy is built on. Those are the building blocks of democracy. And so we're finding that notwithstanding the rhetoric about democracy, right now the elites are pursuing economic policies that undermine the construction of democracy in these countries.
Well, just again to underline that, at the time of the discussion of NAFTA, when that passed, there were these so-called side agreements that dealt with the issues of workers' rights and environmental quality, and that was supposed to be built into this. That yes, the idea of this was to promote trade, but that also that these other two things would happen. We would try to do something about workers' rights and about environment. You're saying that
there were afterthoughts, yeah, that Clinton threw in to placate labor and human rights advocates in the United States, but really they don't have the kind of force of law, mm-hmm, that they would have had if they'd been a part and parcel of that trade agreement. So we see right now that there are violations taking place, in Mexico. And I mean, look at this, the teachers recently in Mexico. And so you don't really have, they don't have the kind of force of law. We want them to be a part and parcel of the trade agreement. And they're just sort of these side agreements that were thrown in as an afterthought.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really important point. And I think some of the things that we can do to draw attention to some of the global issues, especially by helping support NGOs, non-governmental organizations that are trying to document and trying to provide witness to some of the injustices and then getting that information out. I think a lot of people are not aware of some of the conditions going on in other countries. I mean, it's so hard to be aware of what's going on in our own country. And so I think being able to get that information and get it out and get people talking about it is extremely important. And also when talking to people, especially I think people feel that they have to focus on saving preserving Americans' rights, and so it's hard to focus on other countries, is to remind people that if you know, unless every country has the ability to have the right to organize, no one has it. You know, one country, if only one country has it, if the U.S. has it, but, you know, it isn't in Latin America, all the countries are going to go to Latin America because it's going to be, you know, more, you know, profit-making for them. So it's important that all the countries have it. Otherwise, no one really does have that right guaranteed. Mm-hmm.
I'm interested in having James Tindwa talk a little bit about the recent effort in the city of Chicago to require the big box stores to pay the living wage. And I think this is interesting. There have been places around the country where there have been living wage campaigns organized. And so now there are places, and I'm not sure how many, but I know that there are some places where if you do business with government, you have to pay a living wage.
Right. Of course, you know, the city councils and municipalities have a right to do that. But the general context is that if I may just offer a pedestrian definition of globalization, this is where really they want it's literally the race to the bottom in which corporations are seeking to maximize profits, and in the process they want to avoid paying workers high wages. They want to find places where they can get away with paying the least amount of pay to and compensation to workers. And so we're seeing that in this country too, there's that push to marginalize workers. The likes of Walmart and some of the big retailers, their whole business model is predicated on rests on low wages and the suppression of worker rights. I mentioned early on that Walmart does not have any organized stores in the United States. You know, so that's sort of the business model that Walmart has become an emblem of. But we also we're making the case that that business model is implicated in the job loss. The hemorrhaging of jobs that's underway in the United States is a result of that business model, because what Walmart does with so much market share is that they're putting a lot of pressure on suppliers to come up with those cheap products. And suppliers oftentimes do that by forcing unions or workers to renegotiate wages. And in the worst cases, they actually close shop and move overseas. And so to the extent that they are part of the problem, they're part of the deindustrialization, the job loss that has been affecting so many communities, when they come in and say, well, they are the de facto replacement of those high-paying unionized jobs that we are losing, we want to force them to pay a living wage. We might never replace those union jobs, those $20 per hour, $30 per hour jobs, but we want them to be responsive to these communities that have been affected by the business model that they are pursuing. But the larger, also another important issue is that with this transformation of the economy, the shift in the economy, if I can just go back a little bit, 70, 80 years ago, when the factories were opening up and they too were not high-paying jobs. They're pretty dangerous, low-wage, sweatshop-type jobs. The reason they became good-paying jobs is that unions got in and organized them. Now, if those are the jobs we are losing, effectively replacing them with service sector retail-type jobs, we're in trouble if we can't organize these new jobs and raise wages. So this is, for all intents and purposes, the new paradigm. The question now for us, for policymakers, for community organizers, is what we're going to do about it. Are we going to just accept the status quo of a low-wage economy, or do we, in fact, have an obligation to force them to raise wages? We'd like to do it the traditional way by helping workers organize. But if Walmart has closed that door, if the option to organize does not exist at Walmart, what else can we do but to go to local city councils, to go to legislatures, and actually legislatively force it? Mm.
Well, there was enough support on the city council to pass this, to require somebody who, if they're going to come along and set up, and the idea was you're going to set up a new store in the city of Chicago, you would have to pay the living wage. The mayor didn't support it. He said, well, what that's going to mean is they're just going to say, well, if you're going to make that requirement on me, I just won't open my store in the city of Chicago. Where does this now stand right now? I mean, do you think there's continued support for this idea?
Yeah, that's the kind of blackmail that companies use all the time. The fact of the matter is that even by the Wall Street Journal's own editorial 3 weeks ago. Walmart has exhausted small towns. They can't build anymore, and they're reaching saturation in suburbs. The reason there's such a frenzy to build in big cities like Chicago with a $350 billion market is that that really is the last frontier for them to conquer. They have to enter the big cities in order to maintain current growth levels. If they don't do that, they're doomed. So, of course, they couch it in the language of they come in to help, you know, low-income black communities, and it's couched in this sort of language of largesse. They can't survive without entering the big city. The question for us, which is very frustrating, is why the City Council of Chicago and Mayor Daley haven't used this leverage. That there's actually a reversal here. There was a time cities used to, you know, they're giving all kinds of money to attract the industry. This is a situation where industry actually wants to come to the city, and the big cities actually have the leverage. Why they haven't used it, you know, is a very good question. But if Chicago has stood its ground and said you got to pay a living wage to come to Chicago and pay health care, Walmart would have done it. There's no question about that because they don't have any other place to go.
So you think that threat that they were saying, well, we just won't go there, or the mayor I think himself said, look, if you do this, that the businesses won't locate here. You think that is an empty threat, and in fact it's a market they feel that they have to be in, and if it was there and in place, that they would say, well, they would have to live with it.
They would have paid it. As a matter of fact, right. This was just—it was a failure of leadership. Chicago has paid $10 million to Target in tax abatements, and another $1 million was given to the company to build a beautiful rooftop garden. Consequently, Target has its most profitable store located in Chicago. Why can't city officials say to Target, look? We gave you $10 million. We helped you beautify this store. Chicago consumers have given you the most profitable store in the country. Why does that sound like such a radical notion that we should ask you to pay a living wage to the workers as a way to reciprocate? I mean, this is there's a failure of leadership across the board. The tax abatements companies get from cities should be enough to force them to pay back somehow, and the least they can do is pay a living wage.
Hmm. Is this an issue that's something people talking about in Champaign-Urbana, Champaign County?
Well, definitely. I mean, with the fact that we have definitely, I think, more Walmarts than we need in the Champaign-Urbana area, and, I mean, given, you know, the state of the way Walmart works, where they play the game of, well, if you're not going to let us build in your city, we'll build 1 mile outside the city limit. It is definitely an important issue because Walmart does employ so many people. And one way to think about it is that when Walmart isn't giving people or any of these companies, large companies, aren't giving their workers good benefits or any health benefits or good wages, we end up paying as taxpayers, paying to subsidize people having to use emergency room as their only source of health care, things like that. So this is something that is in our best interest to ask or demand that Walmart and other companies provide these things, because in a sense it is going to be good for the economy to have workers have that ability where they're not, you know, having to call in sick a lot because they do have the health care that they can take care of themselves. So it's definitely an important issue in Champaign-Urbana. And when you go to Danville, we have a big issue with the mine workers, which, I mean, we've heard about the mine tragedies in the past year or so. And, you know, Danville has a huge number of Peabody mines, and Peabody is one of the largest or is the largest mine owning company in the United States. And at one point, I think about 20, 30 years ago, majority of them were unionized. At this point, almost none of them are. And they currently have mine workers who are trying to organize but are getting threatened and are being fired for trying to organize. And they're organizing for safety conditions. I mean, people are, you know, going into these mines and getting maimed because of just improper conditions in the mines. So I think for us locally, this is definitely a very important issue. What, you know, whether it's a retail issue or looking at something like mine workers, you know, and all the different industries, you know, looking at University of Illinois, again, it's an important issue because we have people who really need these workers' rights. And when they don't get it, are going to use, you know, alternatives like emergency rooms, et cetera, for health care. And I think that's the health care, I think, is one of the biggest issues, especially in Champaign-Urbana.
We're on a midpoint here. Let me introduce again the guest in the studio with me, the Reverend Jen Tayagi. She is the executive director and also campus minister of the Illinois Disciples Foundation. And joining us by telephone from Chicago is James Tindua. He's the executive director of the Chicago Jobs with Justice Coalition. He's been a social activist for quite a long time. He was, when he came here as a college student, involved in the divestment movement, trying to persuade colleges and other institutions to divest their holdings in South Africa. After that, he spent a number of years with the Ohio and Indiana affiliates of the consumer advocacy group Citizen Action before he went to Chicago, where he was also lead organizer for another advocacy group, Metro Seniors in Action, and now since 2002 has been the executive director of the Chicago Jobs with Justice Coalition. He will be here in Champaign-Urbana tomorrow to take part in the Illinois Disciples Foundation annual fall dinner. He's going to be giving the keynote talk, and this is tomorrow. And anybody who is interested in attending this should feel like they can come by.
Definitely. The tickets are $20 each, but we will not be turning anyone away for lack of fun. So you should definitely come if you're interested in hearing what James has to say. It's going to be a great event. Foodini's is catering the food, and we also have donations from Jerusalem Restaurant, and there will be a raffle. So it overall will be a great evening. The doors open at 5 p.m. at the Illinois Disciples Foundation, which is the northwest corner of Springfield and Wright, and the event will probably go until about 8:30 or so.
Questions also, by the way, questions, comments on these issues here, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I want to ask James Tindua to talk a little bit about immigration, because I know this is something that you like to talk about as an issue that's connected with these other things that we've talked about, and certainly now as a national issue, it is one that is of concern. People are concerned about on the problem of, as they see it, a problem of immigration with people who come here illegally. You make the argument that if you're concerned about that, then you ought to be concerned about these other things, particularly workers' rights, because all these things, that and the kinds of trade agreements that we make with other countries, right. You would argue that all those things are all tangled up together.
Yes. You know, the former governor of New York, Mario Cuomo, was fond of saying that legislation should not be passed in the heat of passion, that every time there's a an emotional issue, legislators should avoid trying to pass legislation to address it. You need to wait and calm down a little bit. I think we're seeing in this country that, when legislators respond to something in the moment of emotion, that you always end up with bad policy, you know. It happened with 9/11, with the Patriot Act, but I don't want to get into that. With immigration, I think we're seeing sort of a very highly charged issue. And we don't think really that's the most conducive moment to really come up with a rational response. Now, having said that, I think that what's actually very sad about this is that the conversation around immigration in this country has taken place outside its most important context, which is globalization itself, and in particular trade agreements that are tending to create havoc and dislocation in countries in the global south and places like Mexico. When NAFTA was passed here in 1993, one of the justifications for it, and I remember Al Gore in a debate with Ross Perot saying that, this is going to bring relief. It's going to actually slow down and reduce undocumented immigration. They used that to pass the document. We were saying that if you don't insist on allowing workers to organize and really building democracy in signatory countries like Mexico, this is going to make immigration worse. Well, since NAFTA has passed, by a lot of accounts, there's not a consistent number here, but by some accounts, 6 million Mexican farmers and their families and workers have been forced off the land because they can no longer compete with the cheap products that are coming from the United States that are produced under this sort of heavy mechanization and therefore they're dumping corn and in Mexico where the locally produced corn is actually more expensive than American corn. So those farmers are going to Mexico City. They're ending up trekking north to find jobs in the United States. Alas, the same politicians who passed NAFTA are now at the border, saying that the way to respond to this is to shut our borders, build walls, and punish people, call them felons when they come here. So there's been a failure to really contextualize this, to deal with immigration from that point of view that says we need to revisit some of these trade agreements. We need in the long run to really think about building democracy and stability in those countries when people can join unions in their own countries, they can fight to raise wages on the job, create environmentally safe conditions and have human rights. They have less of an incentive to actually move. Moving is a very difficult thing. I speak as an immigrant myself. It's very, very difficult. It's not something people do willy-nilly. You don't just get up and say, I want to go to America. These people are leaving family behind. They're leaving their pets behind. They're leaving, high school buddies and extended families. And, it's a very tough decision to make. So I think most Americans think this is people just coming because they want to come. But we need to start talking to people rationally about sort of the larger context in which immigration is taking place.
Mm. Well, I guess I suppose there are some people who would make the argument, though, that people who are concerned about protecting American jobs should also be concerned about immigration.
Absolutely.
Because those people who are looking at the United States and saying, well, here it's a much better opportunity for me than I've got here where I am, so I'm going to go take all the risks that come with it, and I'm going to kind of go, that those people are then, they may be taking jobs from American workers. So they might be saying, well, you guys who are labor organizers, you ought to be strongly with us who are down there at the border, who are trying to keep people from coming across because those people potentially take jobs from American workers.
Right. Jen, do you want to take that or I can
sure. I mean, I think one of the issues with that is mainly that it's not the problem. I mean, there's always going to be people who are willing to take jobs and take poor paying jobs, unsafe jobs. We're always going to have, unless, we get countries where people do have the workers' rights, you're going to always have that problem. And so instead of, I think, addressing the people that are coming to take the jobs, because you're always going to have someone to replace that, even if we solve, why Mexicans are coming across, you're going to have another group that will be in that position, addressing why we have those types of jobs available and how is that being allowed in our country, and looking at the context of globalization, looking at the context of worker rights in the United States. I think that's what's allowing, that's the mechanism that allows this to happen and not, so I don't think we should be making an enemy out of the people coming, because there's always going to be another person, another family to come. And right. So I think that's one of the biggest problems is we've kind of also infused terrorism into this issue of immigration, of the borders being unsafe. And by doing that, we've made it an us versus them, scenario. And that isn't the way to look at it. We need to look at the larger picture of why are there, these jobs in the United States that they can get that are, low paying and are taking jobs away from other people.
Right. Let's be clear. Americans are losing their jobs when GM closes down and lays off 30,000 workers. And Ford does the same thing, and Delphi does the same thing. These immigrants aren't causing that. The outsourcing that's going on is a function of both trade agreements and a lot of greed going on. Some of the companies that are relocating are doing so even when they're profiting. So I think Americans need to start looking at what the main problem is. Mexican immigrants are not causing the outsourcing. Having said that, if we agree that we've got 12 million undocumented people in the United States, and if we agree that we can't deport them, I think rational people would agree that that's not a practical solution. Then the obvious question is, what do we do with them? If you want to punish them and keep them on the margins of the economy where they have no rights, then they will continue to pose a threat to American workers. That's when they do the most damage. The way to resolve that is to confer rights to them. Let's regularize their status, legalize their status, so they too can enjoy rights. When they do that, they can join hands with American workers and join unions or form unions and fight together for a living wage, for better health care, and maybe even join hands in a sort of broader political project involving other important issues such as national health care, dealing with global warming, a lot of issues that workers can participate in solving together. But as long as they're going to be here as 12 million people, and as long as they can't be deported, I think those people right now who are saying, they're really they have an impact, they have a disproportionate impact on low-wage workers. What we're seeing here are people who traditionally have had no interest in addressing the issue of low-wage workers in this country. A lot of Republicans and some Democrats who are talking about this voted against the minimum wage in the Congress. So you have politicians who are suppressing wages, opposing living wage, opposing an increase in the minimum wage, who now have a newfound concern for the plight of low-wage American workers that are being threatened by undocumented immigration. I think the answer might be if you raise minimum wage, if you pass living wage protocols across the board, then employers don't have the option to play workers off against each other. You know, so there's a lot of hypocrisy going on here.
Mm. Well, just you touched on something that I was thinking about myself. Is there for people who are interested in organizing workers? I suppose there's some self-interest here. You'd like to be able to organize people who are here working, want to be here, perhaps would like to be citizens, but are at the moment undocumented. You'd like
right.
to be able to organize those people.
Well, absolutely. You know, and a low wage worker who feels the threat has a better chance, they improve their opportunities if they can join hands and organize together with our immigrant workers, rather than spend time joining the Minutemen and you know, trekking the country and fighting to build walls and you know, border patrols. That won't solve it. What will solve it is a recognition that these workers are in fact victims of globalization, victims of economic dislocation, and that politicians have a responsibility to treat them with respect. We know how to treat immigrants in this country. An example of that is how Cuban immigrants are treated. You know, the current discourse right now has been so punitive, so negative, and so harsh. You know, we Americans know how to treat immigrants. Yeah, how come Cubans are treated differently? You know, what seems to be the difference? And so we need to go back to being human beings and to treating each other with respect and to addressing problems based on fact, and not you know, manufactured facts that are coming out of the Minutemen and other organizations.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's definitely very important because the United States is based on immigration. To ignore that fact, I think, is really sad when looking at the current situation. So I think we need to look at that fact. I know, I mean, with my family, my dad being an immigrant to this country, it is something, as James was saying, that, you know, people don't just kind of decide to go and it's not a big deal. It's a huge deal immigrating to a country, and you have to go through so many obstacles to survive in that country because you are starting from the bottom. And so I think looking at the fact that we are a country based on immigration and that, you know, the immigrants that are here and that are coming do add value to our country, we need to kind of put ourselves, instead of just looking at the United States, put ourselves in the context of the whole world. Because I think when we only focus on us as the U.S., we tend to kind of lose sight of globalization and lose sight of these other factors that are affecting all this. And then we can't really clearly address the situation without being, I think, being emotional and not being fair or looking at the facts.
Let's talk about minimum wage for a bit because, you know, periodically we have these battles over minimum wage in the Congress. Now the here in the state of Illinois, it's something of an issue there. Some people would like to see the minimum wage increased. And so we have these very, very kind of bitter fights over what some people would say was a pretty small amount of money. The minimum wage itself is not very much. And when you talk about raising it, it doesn't really amount to a whole lot. How significant is, say we couldn't increase the minimum wage, how significant would that be to workers? And then how do you respond to those concerns, particularly the concerns of small business that say, I'm having a tough time now. If you require me to pay my workers more, I guess I'll have to do that. But maybe that means I can't afford to have as many workers because of that requirement.
Yeah. Well, you know, the way to answer that is to go and ask workers whether they want a minimum wage increase or not. I think universally it's the workers who are demanding it. But we also know that the empirical evidence does not support the notion that businesses suffer when minimum wage goes up. The states in the United States that have increased the minimum wage have also seen a corresponding improvement in their economy. But let me, I'm fond of, because I think too often we are disconnected from history, and I think it's important to always place things in a context. In the last 20 to 30 years, the policymakers in this country have been lecturing to poor Americans about the dignity of labor. Get off public assistance. We're going to shut down welfare. You're going to get out in the marketplace and find a job. Poor people are living up to their end of the deal. We have a lot of people, millions of poor folks, former welfare recipients, who are now on the job market. It is ironic, and it's sad. It's very sad to me that the same politicians are now standing at the gates of city councils and in the Congress, ready to protect wealthy corporations like Walmart from having to pay a living wage, and protecting wealthy companies from having to pay a minimum wage. They ought to go to their corporate buddies and say, "Look, we've told poor folks to get a job. We believe in the dignity of labor. You have an obligation to pay people decent wages and stop fighting and stop whining." So this is sort of the double message, mixed message that's being sent to poor Americans, is that we believe in work, but we're gonna do everything possible to frustrate your transition to a decent job that's actually gonna allow you to escape poverty. And I don't know how people, the listeners, will really think about this, but that's a hard question we need to think about, because the people living welfare today who can't get a decent job that pays a living wage, a lot of them are having to take two or three jobs at minimum wage. And what happens to their kids? Their kids are left to the vagaries of the street, where they too are on a track to prison or some other, a lot of trouble in society. Then the taxpayers are asked to foot the bill for these prisons. When parents aren't spending enough time with their kids because they're out there with two or three jobs, society pays a price. So we have a collective interest as a society in making sure that people are making decent wages, where they have enough quality time with their children, and that they raise decent, healthy children. So there's a social stability argument that we make in favor of raising wages for workers.
Yeah, and I think that's, one of the most important things about a living wage is that, if you look at the minimum wage currently, and if you're trying to work, one full-time job on that, say no benefits and raise a family, you can't do that. And so we need to be able to empower people to be able to work and support themselves and support their family, but at the same time be able to be active participants in their family. And I think another important part when we talk about a living wage, it's not just to, what actual money you're making per hour, but looking at also things like healthcare, which is a hugely important thing, because, if you don't have healthcare, you're not going to be able to take care of your health problems. You're going to be using things like the emergency room to do that, which is definitely taxing. The studies show that it is taxing on our economy, and it comes out of taxpayers' money to make sure that healthcare is being provided for families, for workers, because that's something that also benefits society as a whole and helps further workers, and the workers can do better when they are healthy.
Can I just add one more thing to this context I'm talking about? That the other context is this issue of CEO compensation, that as these companies are fighting against living wages and minimum wage increases, if you look at the pattern over the last 20 years or so, you're seeing high profitability. You look at Wall Street and the stock market, companies are doing quite well, but their workers are making less and less money. CEOs, Walmart CEO H. Lee Scott makes $35 million per year. He makes $16,000 per hour. His workers make $7.30 per hour. A Walmart worker makes $16,000 per year. It takes him one full year to make what this guy makes in 1 hour. But he was in Chicago paying lawyers and lobbyists money, so that they can fight against a worker who simply wants $10 per hour. There's something wrong with this picture, and I think most people in this country are offended that people can work full-time and still be poor. I think there's broad consensus in the United States that people who are working, at the very least, we don't want anybody to be poor, but at the very least, those who are working should not be poor. I think we can agree on that.
We do have a caller here to bring into the conversation. Let's do that. Someone who is in Champaign and on our line number one. Hello.
Yeah, I just wanted to say I really enjoy what your guests have been saying. They've really hit some very important points. I noticed in the paper today that tonight, 2020, a rather conservative TV news magazine, is going to have a special about how the wealthy are far more privileged than normal Americans. But I guarantee you they won't hit as salient a point as what your guests have been talking about. in particular in the way that they frame the dual messages that are given to workers. And one other comment, when small business says that they can't survive if the minimum wage is increased, a lot of that is due to they should look at the cost of their other costs, such as cost of capital, real estate costs. Real estate in particular is the racket that's involved in real estate, from the commissions to the brokers to the way they add fees in and they pay each other. There's a wonderful article on CNN.com from Money, I believe, magazine, which you can access, which details that. But anyway, I wanted to bring up those points, and thank you very much for having these guests. Thank you.
Well, thanks for the call. You want it, James Satino? You want to comment on anything,
caller? Yeah, I think the caller has it right. Again, historically, every time they've raised the minimum wage, the same cries go out. You know, I like to ask the spokesperson for industry. I've asked so many times in debates and other forums, you know, have you ever supported an increase? It's always like, well, you know, we don't like the indexing, and you know, they find something else that's wrong with it. But for the most part, they're really ideologically opposed to raising the minimum wage. They give all these other excuses that, at the end of the day, have not been supported by the facts. It's an ideological obstacle. That's all it is. But you know, if you think about it, when workers are making decent wages, you know, Republicans, let me say one more thing. Republicans, in particular, are fond of saying, when they justify their tax cuts, that if you put more money in the hands of workers, you know, workers know how to spend it better than the federal government. Have you heard George Bush say that? He says that, right? If that theory holds true, why does it not apply to giving workers a living wage? Why is that not good for the economy? If tax cuts mean much more money in the hands of workers and therefore good for the economy, we think the logical step to take is pay workers more money.
You know, we've been talking here about wage issues. We've talked about minimum wage. We've talked about living wage. And I guess I want to make sure that people understand the concept of living wage, because these are really kind of two different things. And I'm sure that from place to place, what you calculate to be your living wage may well be different. But I'm also expecting that it's going to be higher than minimum wage. In round figures, what exactly are you talking about?
Jen, you want to take that?
Sure. I don't know the exact figures because it does vary from different areas, but it is definitely very disparate from the minimum wage.
I would think it'd be more than the minimum wage.
Definitely. I mean, one of the things that you have going on, especially with this concept of a living wage, is that you have people trying now to redefine what a living wage is. So whether or not it's a family with four children versus, well, most families have two children, let's say, different politicians trying to redefine it so that they can make the living wage smaller or calculate it to be smaller. But I mean, it's based on different factors of, you know, a typical family of, you know, a certain amount of children, certain, you know, living costs that need to be covered, basically to be able to, you know, work a full-time job and to live your life and be able to cover your expenses.
Yep.
And so that does vary, you know, from area to area, because, of course, you know, living costs between Champaign, Urbana versus Chicago are extremely different.
Yeah.
So that is something that changes. James, if you have specific numbers.
No, I think, there's variability based on location, based on standards of living in different areas. For example, in San Francisco, the living wage is over $11. In Chicago, it's $10. But what the living wage does, it pushes people slightly above the poverty line, so that, you know, you're not poor. The minimum wage is sort of the floor that the federal government has set to prevent corporations from really going down the low road to where, you know, they're paying people, you know, sweatshop wages, that sort of thing. So it's the very minimum required to maintain a modicum of stability for workers. But, living wage protocols are becoming very popular because of this idea I touched on early on, that, you know, we're saying that people who work full-time, people who have jobs, shouldn't have to be poor. And the living wage is the answer to that.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And I think that's just a very important issue that has to be addressed sooner rather than later in our country.
I think we do have another caller here before we run out of time. I want to get them again in Champaign, line one. Hello?
Very interesting conversation. I'll make this real quick. Two points. One, as far as small businesses closing, because the minimum wage goes up a quarter, 50 cents, even a buck, in my opinion, what that means is it wasn't a viable business. If you've got 10 or 20 employees and you can't afford to pay them a little bit extra, that means that your business wasn't really in the red anyway. In the black anyway. So it is going to weed out some of the non-viable businesses. So I think that's a fair point. The other thing is, the second point, when you think about the living wage or even raising the minimum wage, I think the bottom line that nobody wants to talk about is what we're saying is if you can't afford to raise children, you shouldn't have children. And nobody wants to tell the poor that we're going to go ahead and have a financial quota. If you don't earn X number of dollars, you can't have children. And that's the real bottom line. If we made politicians who vote against minimum wage increases and living wage standards, then we would find, I think, if we made them admit that that's what they're saying, we'd see a whole different debate. I'll let you go ahead and respond.
No, okay. James, you're going to do that? Or whoever wants?
Well, I mean, that's definitely an interesting take on it. I mean, it's true that I think, I mean, when talking about the poor, we do have to address some of the stereotypes or discrimination that our policymakers have towards the poor. As to that specific issue, I'm not really sure if that is the case in terms of what they're saying. But I don't know, James, if you have something to add to that.
No, I think that, you know, I assume the caller, it seems like there's a libertarian streak there somewhere. But I think that people have a right, as a matter of a human right, to have families if they want to. I think governments cannot be interfering in that kind of social engineering. The issue is accountability. It's policymakers. We have to make them accountable, you know, because on the one hand, they're talking this good game about the importance of work, and then they're frustrating the ability of people to earn a decent wage. You know, they get pay increases, I mean, four times now in the Congress, or I think over the past 10 years. You know, so they raise their wages, they have really decent health care benefits. And so I think that there's an issue of accountability here as far as policymakers are concerned.
Well, we're going to have to stop because we're here at the end of the time. We would like to say thanks to our two guests joining us by telephone, James Tindwa. He's executive director of the Chicago Jobs with Justice Coalition. And here in the studio with me is the Reverend Jennifer Tiaghi. She's the executive director and campus minister of the Illinois Disciples Foundation, now working on social justice issues in Champaign-Urbana for over 100 years. They celebrated their 100th birthday last year?
Yeah, last about a year and a half ago.
Yeah, and this weekend, our guest here, James Tindwa, will be here to speak at their fall dinner at the Illinois Disciples Foundation. He'll be giving the keynote address, speaking on a lot of these issues, and anybody who's interested can attend.
You can give us a call at 217-352-8721 or check us out online at www.prairienet.org/IDF.
All right. Thank you both very much.
And thank you for having us.